Welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we have economist Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, an economic think tank in Washington, and he blogs at Beat the Press, a commentary on economic reporting in the mass media. In 2006, Dr. Baker wrote a book, The Conservative Nanny State, which is going to be the subject of our interview today. It really challenges the conventional wisdom out there that conservatives support free markets and progressives support government intervention. So that's going to be the focus of our interview, and we're going to be talking about some issues surrounding the book, so please stick around. Thanks so much. Dean Baker, thanks so much for this interview. As I mentioned, I wanted to talk about your book and some issues surrounding the book, if that's okay.
Okay.
The main thrust of your book is how there's this conventional wisdom out there that conservatives support free markets and progressives support government intervention. But as you point out in the book, there are so many contexts that this isn't really the case at all. Could you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, there's a wide range of policies that end up that are supported by conservatives that tend to have the effect of distributing income upwards that we typically don't talk about as being regulation, but in fact they are, regulation of government involvement. To just take one that's really pretty obvious in the current environment, the too-big-to-fail doctrine for banks. We've had this implicit idea, which has now been made explicit, that if banks, other financial institutions, got themselves in trouble, and at least if they were big enough, the government would step in and bail out the creditors. And they did that in over the last year, that the creditors of every major financial institution were protected, with the one obvious notable exception of Lehman Brothers. So if you'd lent money to Bear Stearns, you'd lent money to AIG, or Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, many other institutions that have since gone under in the last year, you were just fine. The government bailed you out, and you end up being just fine. So that was government intervention of a really big scale, totally supported by conservatives, and it had the effect of, at least disproportionately, protecting higher-income people. So that's kind of an obvious one that's been very visible now, but it's easy to identify many others. For example, patents and copyrights. These are not natural features of the market. They serve a purpose, but they patents obviously give an incentive for innovation. Copyrights give an incentive for doing creative work, but they are government policy. They may be good policy, but they're government policy. But yet people often talk about these as though they're just natural. They just grew up by themselves, and it's just a completely false characterization. They're government policy. We have other ways, we do have other ways of supporting innovation, of supporting creative work. This is one way, maybe it's the best way, maybe it's not. But the point is government policy. So you could identify many, many other cases where the government has structured the economy in certain ways that, as I argue, often tend to have the effect of distributing income upwards. But these structurings of the economy are supported by conservatives, often by people who consider themselves liberal or progressive as well. But the point is, their interference is in the market. They're not just the market being left to itself.
Another example that you give is corporations and their limited liability privileges. That's not really coming just arising out of the free market.
That's right. Corporations are a creation of the government. You or I could form a partnership. We could go get in together and start a store, start a factory, whatever it might be. And that doesn't involve the government, but if we want a corporation with corporate status, perhaps most importantly, limited liability, we could do harm to people, and then you or I aren't liable. They could sue our corporation, and if our corporation goes bankrupt, we've inflicted harm on people, and those people are left to suffer. So that's a privilege that the government gives us if we create a corporation. And there's very little recognition that a corporation is a creation of government. It's not the market. Again, that doesn't mean it's bad. I think it's good we have corporations, but the point is you can't say, oh, this is just the free market, no government intervention, free market, no government intervention. You don't have corporations. You have individuals that form partnerships.
One more example, of which you give many in the book, is that if you're really consistent with your ideology, you wouldn't only support free trade of goods across borders, but you'd also support free trade of services. So doctors and lawyers and economists would be free to cross borders and offer their services.
That's right. And it's important to understand, when we look at trade agreements, people often talk about tariffs and quotas as being the main issue in trade agreements. It really hasn't been the case for a long time. Our tariffs have been quite low for many, many years, and quotas, we have some here and there, but those aren't the big factors in trade. If you look, for example, to the North American Free Trade Agreement, obviously a very hotly contested trade agreement, our tariff barriers to Mexico were already very low. They're on the order of 3 or 4%. So our tariffs were not excluding Mexican products from the U.S. market. What that agreement was about was negotiating terms that made it as easy as possible for U.S. corporations to set up operations in Mexico and export their output back to the United States. So what we were trying to do was deal with the institutional barriers. What we talked to the corporations in the U.S., to General Motors, General Electric, other big corporations, and asked them, what is it that prevents you from setting up a shop, setting up a factory in Mexico, producing your goods there, and sending them back to the United States? And we constructed an agreement that was designed to eliminate those barriers, eliminate those obstacles. So it wasn't the tariffs that they were concerned about. It was what were the institutional obstacles. They were concerned that if they set up a factory in Mexico, it might be expropriated. The Mexican government, you might get a leftist Mexican government, they expropriate the factory. So the tariff has, NAFTA has wording that makes it difficult for the Mexican government to expropriate their factory. They were also worried Mexican government might make restrictions saying that General Electric can't send their profits back to the United States. NAFTA has wording says Mexican government can't do that. They can't restrict General Electric. General Electric, if they want, they could send their profits wherever they want to. They were also concerned that there could be an issue where, let's say, they're successfully exporting large amounts of whatever they produce there back to the United States. So in the United States, they get a state or the national government to put up a barrier in the form of a safety barrier, an environmental restriction. Well, they got wording that made that very difficult, if not impossible, to do. So they crafted NAFTA not first and foremost to lower tariffs. It did do that, but that was really a sidebar. The most important point was to change institutional structures to make it easy for U.S. manufacturing corporations to set up operation in Mexico and export back to the United States. So that put U.S. manufacturing workers direct competition with low-paid workers in Mexico. Now, they could have done the exact same thing with the professions, with the highly paid professions. They could take a look at our doctors, our lawyers, our accountants, our economists, and said, well, what is it? Go to universities. Well, why aren't you hiring smart economists from Mexico who get the right degrees, or the hospitals? How come you don't have a lot of Mexican doctors would be really happy to work for wages that would be considered quite low in the United States by doctors? We didn't do that. We didn't try to remove those barriers. So it was a very one-sided free trade agreement. We were happy to remove the barriers that had the effect of protecting less educated, we'll say non-college educated workers, from competition with their counterparts in Mexico. At the same time, we left in place the barriers that have the effect of protecting doctors, lawyers, and the most highly educated workers in the U.S. economy.
In your book and in some talks you've given, I've heard you talk about how the market is really an effective tool with its ability to bring competition. For example, in one of your healthcare reform proposals, you talk about how we can really use the market to create competition and let people buy into Medicare. So if they like it, there's a market for it, and people can buy into Medicare if they want. And then, you know, you mentioned in this vein that market is really a tool, and it makes no more sense to lash out against markets than it does to lash out against the wheel. So it's accurate to say that you're not against markets at all, right?
No, not at all. I think markets are great. We just have to decide where we want to use them, how we want to use them, and think seriously about what you hope to get accomplished. So you have a lot of people that treat the market like it will accomplish great things by bringing the market. So there's been this effort to privatize a lot of public services over the last 10 or 15 years, and you go, okay, what do we think that will accomplish? And usually what that often, or I shouldn't say usually, but in many cases what accomplishes is it gives contracts to insiders who are politically connected. That's not good use of the market. But there are many places where we can effectively use the market, and I'm all for doing that. So I think what we want to do is figure out what we hope to accomplish through the market, use the market where it's helpful, and it's foolish to lash out against the market. I don't want everything to be done by the government. Some things the government doesn't necessarily do particularly well, so I don't really want the government to rush in and, you know, take over housing for the country or take over production of food. There's all sorts of things I don't really want the government to do. But there are areas where the government does have a track record where it has done things very well. I was talking about Medicare a moment ago. The administrative costs of Medicare are much lower than for private insurance companies. So it seems to me, why wouldn't we want to expand Medicare? Let people buy into it. I'd be happy with a single payer system, but rather than force everyone into a system, you could let Medicare system compete with private insurers. My guess is that in a fairly short period of time, probably most of the private insurers would be out of business, but that's something you could leave to the market.
The reason why I'm asking this is because the word market has become almost taboo in certain circles, certain progressive circles. For example, I know there's a recent book out there that has gained a lot of fanfare from a progressive author that really looks at the Chicago School of Economics and markets as almost the villain of basically all of our problems. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think they often had used the market as a cover-up for actually using the government to steer money, in effect, to wealthy individuals, corporations. Just to give you an obvious example, and this very directly related to the University of Chicago people, privatization of Social Security. What do they mean by that, literally? They don't mean, at least I've come across almost no one who means this, just saying you're on your own. You know, go, you know, if you want to save for retirement, go save. If you don't want to save, don't save. I found almost no one, and I've been debating this issue for almost 20 years now, almost no one who says that. What they almost invariably mean is they want to replace a government-run system with a system where, in effect, the government is mandating that people save through private financial companies. And Chile is often held up as the model here by their side, and I think it's a useful model for our side, because that's exactly what they did in Chile. In Chile, they had, this was done under, of course, a dictatorship, the military dictator, Augusto Pinochet, in the early 80s, got rid of their traditional defined benefit Social Security system like what we have in the United States and replaced it with a system where they had mandatory savings in individual accounts. And it turns out there's, at this point, very good analysis on this. It's a very expensive system. The administrative costs take up on the order of 20, 25, even 30% of the amount of money that people put into the system. And interestingly, people vote with their feet not to be in the system, because what happens if you're in the formal sector there, if you're employed by the government, if you're employed by a factory, a large employer, you have to contribute to the system. But much of Chile's economy is the informal sector. People start working off the books. It's true of much of Latin America, much of the developing world. Those people almost invariably choose not to be in the Social Security system. So they vote with their feet not to be in this private system. So the reason for doing it is that they don't like the costs associated with it. They don't trust the financial institutions. And it ends up not being a very good deal for most people. In fact, they recently, their president who was elected a couple of years, actually changed it back to more like the traditional Social Security system. But the market, the people arguing the market, the market, the market, that isn't what they proposed in Chile. What they proposed was requiring people to put money into accounts with private financial institutions, which would in turn get large fees. They would extract a lot of money from worker savings to increase their profits. So this was presented as a case of the government versus the market, and it really wasn't that at all. It was a case of, are we going to, on the one hand, obviously Social Security, it's not voluntary, you have to contribute, so are we going to force people to contribute to a government-run system, or are we going to force people to contribute to a system that's managed through the private financial sector? But it's not one where we're leaving it to the market. We're simply forcing people to contribute to deposit money with the private financial system.
Just want to remind our listeners that this is the Logic Consortium, and we're talking to economist Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and blogger at Beat the Press. We're talking about his view for the role of markets in our society, and also some rebuttals are coming up to some free market economics arguments. So please stick around. Talking about free market economists, you have a lot of those people that are out there that are pretty ardent free marketers, arguing that basically that all government lawmaking faces a ton of problems and that politicians can't make the right decisions because they're all the lobbyists and trying to stay in office and stuff like that. And then when they do make laws, that there are all these unintended consequences. For example, you know, a real out there is among free market economists, they say that minimum wage laws actually have the effect of decreasing the number of lower wage jobs, effectively increasing unemployment among low-skilled workers. So what's your comment to that?
Well, first of all, yes, there are consequences to anything we do, public or private. So, you know, we should always be looking for what the unintended consequences of any action might be. That's fair enough. But they often end up making these arguments as an article of faith, and the minimum wage is a great example there, because it's a reasonable thing to consider. Yeah, we're raising the wage. Can that lead to more unemployment or less, fewer jobs for the people we're most concerned about, the people who are low-wage workers earning at or near the minimum wage? At this point, there's a huge body of research. There have been literally dozens of articles, many of them very careful articles by some of the top economists in the field, who have looked at the disemployment effect of minimum wage, and with almost no exceptions, they find that there's little or no negative employment effect. So we might say, as a matter of ideology or faith, that minimum wages are bad because they're interference with the market. Alternatively, we could just say, well, let's look at what's happened. We have a lot of history now of both state governments and the federal government raising the minimum wage through time. Has it led to large employment effects? And where we'd expect to see this among young people, particularly minority young people, we just don't find it. People have done any number of studies, you just don't find it. So from that vantage point, to my mind, you just say, well, what does the evidence show? And you go based on the evidence rather than some matter of faith that it should create unemployment, because they say we don't find it.
Hypothetically, say that they concede the minimum wage argument and give you a different argument, like that rent control and price controls on housing will definitely decrease supply of housing and rentable properties. And they say that as it's kind of like a science, like it's obvious that it's true. Could you comment on that?
Well, to some extent, it's actually just straight out sloppy from the study of economics. So one of the main constraints, depending on where you're talking about, but when you talk about housing, one of the main constraints, of course, is the supply of land and people's willingness to tolerate development. And in a lot of areas, everywhere has a limited supply of land, but you could have an area where it's all built up and you don't want further development. There's a lot of places where it's a decision of people in a certain city or community that they don't want further development. So that what that means at that point is the supply is pretty much fixed. So if you have a price control, you're not going to affect the supply in any real way. I mean, there's borderline cases where you could talk about apartments being pulled out of use because they're not maintained, but that's, I think, a secondary issue. You could address that. But really, you're simply talking about the distribution between landlords and tenants. And that's not necessarily a bad thing to say that tenants should have more and landlords should have less. I won't necessarily say it's a good thing, but it's a reasonable thing to consider. And you can have a situation where you give rights to the tenant, which make every bit as much sense as giving rights to the landowner. Of course, in many countries, they do that. They often have situations where tenants have a lot of rights. For example, in many countries, you can't just throw out a tenant. You have to, unless you're, say, renovating the property or you have some cause, like the tenant's been creating a problem, the tenant's the right to stay in their rental unit. And also in those cases, people often say that if you have rent control, that landlords won't maintain an apartment. Well, if you have security of tenure, so the tenant knows that they're going to be there as long as they want, well, the tenant will themselves undertake maintenance. So if I'm living in an apartment, I know I'm going to be there the next 10 years, and I realize that the place needs painting, well, I pay for it myself. Landlord's never going to give it to me as a gift anyhow. If the landlord paints it, they're going to expect it back in rent, so it's not as though there's any free lunch there. And if I decide it's time to paint it, well, if I'm the tenant and I'm going to be there 10 years, I'd paint it just the same as if I owned it. It would make perfect sense for me. So in that case, that's not a question moving away from the model. That is the model. Economists are just being sloppy and dishonest when they try to say that they'll necessarily be harmed from rent control, at least when it's in a circumstance like that.
I want to stay with the free marketers for a second and talk about another market solution that people talk about is school vouchers. You know, a lot of people say that some of the problems is that people are stuck in their school and there's really no feedback loop like there is going to the supermarket. For example, if you don't like the supermarket you're going to, you go to another one, or that supermarket has the first supermarket has to change for the better. So they're saying with vouchers there could be this feedback loop that people can choose which school they go to. Could you comment on what you think about that?
Well, there too, there's been a lot of research on this, and what it tends to find is that, for the most part, people who benefit from vouchers, or I should say people get vouchers, don't particularly benefit. And there can be real losers in that story, that if you just open up a system, you go, here, we're going to throw out vouchers, and people who want the vouchers get them, and let's say they're big enough to go to private schools, because very often they're not. It ends up being kind of a joke that they're not really large enough to get into a private school. So what will happen is that families that have a high enough income to supplement it could get their kids into a good school. But most people, the vouchers might not be large enough to get them in a good school. But the other part of the story is we know there's some parents that have the time, the interest, the ability to really pick out the good schools and ensure that their kids will get a good education, other parents less so. So one outcome could be a situation where instead of maintaining the public schools, you just throw all the vouchers out there, is that the parents that really do have the time, the ability to ensure their kids get a good education, they're going to do that. They'll pull their kids out of the schools, and then those that are left are going to be in incredibly inferior schools that don't provide anything resembling a decent education. So if you get that outcome, you're not necessarily making the kids who got the voucher better off, because in many cases those kids would have done well even in, let's say, the traditional public schools. And you're making the other kids a lot worse off, because suddenly the parents that really have the time and ability to ensure that their kids are getting decent education, they're gone. So that's something you have to look at very carefully with vouchers. And again, this is one that people have tried to argue as an article of faith, but at this point, there's a fair bit of research, and the research just doesn't support those claims. The research suggests that it's a very mixed experience. Surely there are cases of kids that benefit from the opportunity to go to a private school, but it's not as though that's the general rule. It's the exception.
Extending that argument a little bit, you have a lot of people who say that healthcare savings accounts can really help control costs of healthcare that have been rising so rapidly. So everybody would have... is envisioned that a certain amount of money, $3,000, $5,000, to spend on healthcare. So then people would be much more vigilant about the money that they spend. They'd say, hey, do I need this doctor's visit? Do I need this procedure? And then there would be a whole market for people telling you, people studying about what's the most beneficial procedure, what's the most beneficial doctor's visit. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, again, I think it's a lot of sloppy reasoning, because when you start... Well, first off, with health savings accounts, you're segregating the market, because there's a logic to that if, let's say that I'm very healthy and I have very few expenses, I'll do very well with that. So I'll end up putting aside $3,000 or whatever it might be, tax-free, and I'll be just fine with that. On the other hand, if you're a person in bad health, that's going to be no use to you, because you're going to be spending the full amount all the time anyhow. And the way this is usually set up, say, for example, how Senator McCain proposed it during the presidential race, or actually President Bush proposed it also a couple years back, it basically would fragment the insurance market so that currently most people are getting insurance through their employer, and that puts you in a pool. So you have some very unhealthy people in most workplaces, and most are, of course, healthy, as most people are. And the less healthy people can get insurance at an affordable cost because they're pooled with the more healthy people. But if we go this individual route, then you're suddenly in a situation where you have people getting insurance on their own, and insurance companies obviously aren't interested in insuring sick people, because sick people cost them lots of money. So in that situation, you have a market where people who are relatively healthy can do fine. They can get insurance. They can put money in the bank and not pay taxes on it, so it's a good deal for them. But the people who really need health care find that they're going to have to pay a huge amount for their insurance policy if they can afford it at all. So again, this is all, it's not a question of a belief in the market. It's what would the market look like? What do we think insurance companies are going to do? They're not beneficent. They're not villains, but they're there to make a profit. And making a profit for your insurance company means trying to avoid insuring people who are sick. So it's not a very good outcome. And again, it's just a question of thinking how the market works, not criticizing the market.
Can you tell us what you think is the proper role for free markets?
Well, there's an awful lot of areas of life where I think the market's a great way for letting economic decisions be made. When I decide I want to get clothes, I think it's great that I can go to the store and pick out the shirt I want, the pants I want, pick out the shoes I want. I don't think the government could decide for me what pants I should be wearing, what shoes I should be wearing. There's an awful lot of areas like that the market does that very, very well. Even in healthcare, you could have some areas where I think the market could perform well. You just have to think carefully about how you're going to do it. So it doesn't make sense to allow insurance companies to pick only the healthy people. Or alternatively, what invariably, let's say we had someone who was proposing that policy and they were a little more serious, what they try and say is, well, we're going to restrict their ability to do that. And my comeback at that point is to always say, well, so you think the government bureaucrats are going to outsmart the insurance companies, which usually they would not want to say that. So you just have to think carefully about how you use the market. And I think it's been a very valuable tool. We've had great innovations that have come about through the private sector where we've had developments in computer technology, auto technology, you pick it, you name it. I mean, there are great developments that have come about through the private sector, very often with assistance from the government. But the two can work very well together. You just have to approach it from a standpoint that you don't assume that leaving everything to the market's going to be great. You think carefully about how the market's working, what you expect the outcomes to be.
I want to close with how you think the left needs to improve their rhetoric when talking about economics. And when I'm talking about the left, I'm talking about those out there that think that there's a role for government to help provide some basic services out there, basic public goods and services such as education and healthcare and the like. Obviously, your book makes a big contribution to that, to try to really change the framework of the debate that, you know, out there, that some think that is almost conventional wisdom, that the right supports markets and the left supports government. But how should the left really be improving our rhetoric to help achieve these goals of some basic government services being provided by government?
I think most people really agree with us on people have a right to health care, they have a right, kids have a right to education, they expect that people who work for a living will have a decent retirement. I think most people agree with us. I think the point is not to use rhetoric that almost seems designed to scare people. I don't want to have to make people take an oath that they, you know, support. You start using terms like redistribution, that scares people. So what I like to do is point out the other side. They want to redistribute upward. And that invariably drives people through the roof. They hate the idea that they might not like the idea of low-income people that they're going to be supporting the deadbeats on TANF or whatever program. Then obviously lots of people have negative images of low-income people, but they also don't like the idea that they're being taxed to make Bill Gates richer or Robert Rubin or Pete Peterson or these various wealthy people they see in the news. They don't like the idea that they're being taxed to make those people wealthier. And very often that is the case. So if we say we want a government that ensures decent levels of services, the ones you and I were just talking about, healthcare, education, retirement, that's what we want the government to do. We want to do it in the most efficient possible way, and that's going to involve a large government role. I don't think people have a problem with that, as long as we're careful to point out, you know, we're looking at this not as a matter of ideology. We don't want a large government role in Social Security because we think that's good. In and of itself, we want a large government role in Social Security because that's the most efficient, effective way to ensure that when people get to retirement age, they have a decent retirement. And we could prove that. So we don't have to ask them to take this from us on faith, and we never should do that. We should say we have the evidence to support our case.
Dean Baker, thanks so much for this interview. I really enjoyed it, and I'm going to continue to follow your work at Beat the Press and at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Great. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed the interview as well. Thanks for having me on.
Now is our interview with economist Dean Baker, blogger at Beat the Press and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, talking about his 2006 book, The Conservative Nanny State, and really trying to reframe the argument and how it isn't as simple as conservatives like markets and progressives like government and intervention. It's really much more complex than that. And he's really saying that progressives shouldn't be scared of saying that they like markets because markets are an effective tool. And I know a lot of his views can really be debated, but it really sets us off a good starting point that progressives shouldn't be scared of saying. As my friend Rather Stanton said, it should be about what works and what doesn't. They shouldn't frame it in terms of markets and non-markets. So thanks so much. Visit our blog at logicconsortium.blogspot.com and download us on iTunes. Thank you.